This is the takeaway for Friday, July 1st, 2016.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
Well, I must tell you, my friends, you who have waited faithfully for the punchline of this speech.
Exactly a week ago, the world was waking up to the shock that the UK had voted unmistakably to sever its ties with the European Union. Today, a week later, politics in London shows no sign of recovery. The loser on the Brexit referendum, Prime Minister David Cameron, wasn't anticipating resigning when he started his Remain campaign. Boris Johnson, former mayor of London, after being the champion of leaving the EU, apparently never really lined up supporters in case of a victory. And yesterday, he pulled out of the running to lead the Conservative Party.
Having consulted colleagues and in view of the circumstances in Parliament, I have concluded that person cannot be me.
Another shocker, revealing that the once rising star Johnson's best talent seems to have been alienating people. Now the attention turns to Justice Minister Michael Gove and Home Secretary Theresa May. And meanwhile, as the UK staggers about looking for a future, the EU is vigorously trying to publicly assert its relevance and power, even without the UK as a member. David O'Sullivan is the ambassador for the EU to the United States. He's one of those so-called faceless bureaucrats who were so demonized by the Leave campaign. He argues the anger toward the EU is fundamentally misplaced.
Firstly, I think that the criticisms of the way the EU functions, I get and I understand. But people, I think, forget too quickly that the European Union is essentially governed by our member states. The bureaucracy in Brussels, which, by the way, is not much bigger than the size of the city council in Birmingham or of a medium-sized German city, exists to implement the wishes of our people. So, respectfully, I don't think that Europe is run by a technocracy or a bureaucracy. It is run by democratically elected representatives of the people.
You know, I'm in America. You know, I don't need convincing, but you can't blame this on Cameron not explaining it well enough to the people. I mean, could you survive a referendum in every one of the EU member countries if it was held next month?
Well, firstly, not all our countries believe that referenda are the best way to settle political issues. To your point about the UK referendum campaign, respectfully, I don't wish to personalize this to Mr. Cameron, but it is not easy if you have been criticizing Europe frequently and loudly down through the years, suddenly in the course of a 6 weeks referendum campaign to explain to people that actually Europe is very good for you. These are complex issues. We're living through difficult times. There's a general sense of malaise in the European population, as there is here, that somehow our systems are not delivering for ordinary people in the way they once did. We should not run away from that discussion. But honestly, to start blaming the European Union as the source of all these problems, in my view, is to mistake the nature of the problem, and more importantly, to turn to solutions which will actually make things worse. I don't think the United Kingdom is going to be a better place as a result of leaving the European Union. And I fear this is what will be demonstrated in the next few years if this turns out to be the case.
Boy, if it's not demonstrated, then you really have an issue of not negativity, but just relevance, which is perhaps even worse.
Well, I mean, I to be clear, I don't wish the British people ill, but I do believe that economic performance is stronger for countries who have joined the European Union than for those who have not. If you look at Poland and how it has developed since the collapse of communism compared, say, to Ukraine, which did not join the European Union, you can see a huge difference of trajectory. I think we don't necessarily do a good job of explaining that. And this is perhaps a moment of truth where we have to have an honest assessment. Do we really believe that this European Union delivers more benefits to our citizens than disadvantages? And I think we have to be willing to take on that debate. And frankly, I think if we do, we actually have a very good narrative.
All right, let me pretend to be a diplomat in the United States now and think about the implications of all of this. It feels as though, just from the perspective of Washington, D.C., why should I spend a lot of time thinking about Brussels? I'll make my own deals with France, Germany, and the U.K. It seems like the TTIP transatlantic trade treaty is out. That's going to have to be renegotiated on a bilateral basis. And, you know, Turkey, forget that. That's not going to happen.
If you don't mind my saying so, John, I hope your diplomats have a slightly more sophisticated understanding of the issues than you've just displayed.
I hope they do too.
Firstly, in terms of trade, why does the EU matter to the United States? The EU is one of the largest economies in the world, with the largest trading bloc by far.
Why should I deal with Brussels and Paris? Why should I deal with
Because when it comes to trade, you can't deal with Paris. The trade deals are decided by the European Union, negotiated by the European Union. When you want sanctions against Russia, they are decided by the European Union, not by individual member states. The sanctions against Iran were decided by the European Union. So the European Union is a hugely important ally for the United States, both economically, commercially, and in terms of foreign policy and security. So these are all the reasons.
That's a very persuasive point, but from the U.S. perspective, doesn't the U.K.'s withdrawal here make those critical issues hard to deliver from Brussels?
I don't see why, because we will still be 27, a slightly smaller market, but still the largest market in the world and the wealthiest market in the world. Of course, it's more complicated if the UK leaves. That's why the Americans didn't want the United Kingdom to leave. We're now going to have to deal with a new situation, which is suboptimal. But I don't agree with you that the trade negotiations are going to stop. Both sides are determined to move forward with this deal, to conclude it this year if we can. We will see what is the relationship of the United Kingdom to that deal.
Can I just ask you? I mean, how worried are you about that deal with the Brits out and Donald Trump railing against trade deals over across the Atlantic?
Well, again, I don't want to comment on your domestic politics. I observe that trade is a difficult issue in this election. I also observe that the animosity in the trade discussion is rather more about the Trans-Pacific Partnership than a deal with Europe. With the UK out, we don't know. For the time being, the UK remains in. If the UK leaves, the UK could also sign on to this deal, even if it were outside the EU. So I think we are going to have to adapt to the new situation, but the fundamental purpose of the European Union, its role in the world, its role in trade and commerce, and its vital interest to the United States in the transatlantic context, in my view, will remain.
All right. You've been very generous, and in listening to my unsophisticated diplomatic analysis here, but I do think that part of this debate is about the inability of voters to see some of the sophistication which is so clear to you and others in Brussels. Don't you understand that trade deals feel to most voters, they feel like a situation where I elect my representatives, I elect my president. They say certain things about wanting to bring prosperity to me, but then they go off and do their own thing regarding these trade deals. And that represents austerity. It represents any number of things that infuriated the Brits, including making Polish people happy. How does this trade deal stop inflaming this sense of intolerance that's everywhere in the world right now? What is going to address that issue?
Well, let's try to unpack some of it logically. In terms of the general sense of public opinion about the benefits of trade or international activity, I agree. We need to do more to persuade people. But let's be very clear, John. The alternative policies which are being proposed are most likely to lead us to disaster. If we start shutting our markets, we will not become better off. We will become less well off. You talk about migration in the United Kingdom. The Poles and the Latvians and the Irish, by the way, who work in the United Kingdom, contribute massively. And the statistics on this are very clear. They are net contributors to the British economy. Now, does this create difficulties? Yes, it creates pressure on public services. The correct response is not to say, let's have fewer immigrants. The answer to this is to say, let's invest in building more schools. Let's invest in having a better healthcare provision.
Very eloquent, Ambassador. But do you have faith then that with all the nationalist voices rising in Europe, that those member countries can in fact do that, can in fact focus on those issues that you say will win the day?
You know, Karl Popper said that optimism is a duty. But more importantly, I actually have great faith in the common sense of the European people. And I believe that if we frame these issues in the right way, if we have the right kind of public debate, I think in the end, people will make the right choices. These are difficult times. There's a lot of anger out there. There's a lot of frustration after the crash of 2008. We should not minimize the legitimate sentiments of the vast majority of people who are not racist, who are not xenophobic, who are not ultranationalist, but who have concerns about the direction their society is moving in. And we should, in an open way, debate how best we can address these issues. But I don't believe that the extreme nationalist, xenophobic positions of many parties around Europe offer those kind of solutions. And I believe in the end, people will see through these false promises.
David O'Sullivan is the ambassador of the European Union to the United States. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much, Ambassador.
Thank you, John.
And later this hour, a treat. Takeaway producer John Asante gets to sit down with the man who inspired him to be a DJ, MTV VJ, Dave Holmes. Holmes has taken every song that's been meaningful in his life and written the story of his life through the music that defined it. It's all packaged up in a neat memoir called Party of One, a memoir in 21 songs. And Holmes says it took the better part of his life to realize that being a party of one isn't so bad after all.
I love this line, actually the first line from your book, where you said that you identify most strongly with the B-Girl and Blind Melon's No Rain video.
Yeah, I absolutely do. Because like that's really the story of my life, is me like flitting from thing to thing, trying to fit in, you know, trying to find the team that will have me, you know. I was always a little bit of an outsider. Like, now that I'm 45, I think that's great. Like, I'm thrilled that I'm an outsider. It's given me a life like no one else's, and I'm very happy with it. I'm very happy with where I ended up. But when you're a kid, all you want to do is join. All you want to do is fit in. And I held on to that feeling for longer than most. And I made a lot of dumb mistakes, and I tried on a lot of hats that did not fit me. But I got some stories out of it.
Later this hour, more from former MTV VJ Dave Holmes. In the fight to stop the manufacture and sale of methamphetamine, in some parts of the country, pharmacists are joining forces with the police. This man, Mark Richards, discovered that last year when he tried to buy some cold medicine at a pharmacy in Nashville and was told to get lost.
I said, "We haven't even asked you yet." And he said, "Well, now you've asked, and I told you no, go away." And I said, "How come?" And he said, "Because you're probably cooking or smurfing."
Cooking and smurfing are slang for the process by which the decongestant pseudoephedrine gets turned into the addictive drug meth in home labs all across the country. That pharmacist in Tennessee basically decided by looking at the customer that he didn't want to sell him pseudoephedrine. In that community, like others around the nation, pharmacists are being given or are taking discretion by turning down sales that are in any way suspicious. The state of Indiana, with a huge meth problem, is permitting pharmacists to be judge and jury, deciding who can and cannot buy pseudoephedrine. It's about to become a state law. But in Fulton County, Indiana, this practice is nothing new. Pharmacy owner Harry Webb says he decided to take matters into his own hands a while ago. Webb is willing to risk discrimination in turning down sales, he says, because he's seen for himself what meth has done in his community.
This is such an addicting drug, so once a person starts doing meth, it's, you know, probably the most addicting substance on the planet, and nothing else matters once that happens. And so the child is in just absolutely neglect. They don't get fed. They themselves become just absorb it through their skin. They will test positive. You know, the wallpaper peels off the damn wall in a meth house because the chemicals used to make it are so toxic, it literally strips the wallpaper. A meth addict will collect their urine in jars. So when they run out of Sudafed, they distill their own urine down and get the meth back out of it and smoke it again. You know, that's what happens in these places. And this drug addiction is more than just the addiction we're trying to address here. We're trying to address all the consequences of everybody else around them. You know, we had a very prominent person in the community that inherited a beautiful home from his father. Great guy, very big, you know, community, but he had this big home. He was a single guy, so he rents out the back bedroom, goes away for the weekend, and the guy cooks meth, burns the house to the ground. You know, it's a $300,000 loss in a nice neighborhood, and now it'll never be a home again because it's just a bare lot that they've sold off to the neighbor.
Is it important to you and your friends that Fulton County not be known as having a meth problem? The reason I'm asking is because people got together when graffiti was a problem in a lot of inner cities and restricted sales of spray paint. And, you know, that eventually became law, but it was a result of ground up community mobilization to make changes. Is that what you're involved with here?
Oh, sure. That's exactly what it is. When we got the chain pharmacies who were pressuring their employees to not restrict sales, when we got them just to agree to do some simple things, like let's just display, there are pseudoephedrine products that are what they call meth deterrent. One of them is called Nexafed. One's called Zephyr XD. Their market share is very minimal compared to the national brands and even the generic products, because a lot of the chains don't even stock them. Because when 90% of the sales is 80 to 90% of the sales is going into meth, well, there's not going to be people buying the meth deterrent product except maybe legitimate people. And so it's been a struggle, but it's such a common sense product. Why not, if you don't know the person, why not just offer them a package of Nexafed and it'll treat their symptoms and everybody's happy. If they are smurfing it and using it to make meth, they're going to turn around and leave. They're not going to buy it because they don't want to burn their Implex transaction on a product they can't make it with. And it's such a common sense thing. Why would not any pharmacy want to do that? Well, the problem was is because a lot of corporate chains were telling their employees they can't do that. You can't even put it in stock.
It occurs to me that this sort of gets at your personal pride at being a pharmacist, as someone who helps people, seeing a product of yours used to destroy neighborhoods.
Exactly. I mean, pharmacists legitimize sales of things every day. You know, we are trained to use what they call DEA red flags to evaluate. You know, we're not just handling Sudafed. We obviously handle a lot of drugs that can be abused. And we're constantly on guard for substance abuse behavior and possible forgeries. And, you know, pharmacists are very trained in spotting that kind of stuff. I mean, it's something we do every day. There has been some pushback saying, well, I don't have time to be doing this with all the pseudoephedrine sales. Well, when you eliminate 80% of your sales, you'll find out that, you know, the average store that has eliminated all the smurfing activity, once you stop one, you stop that whole parade. And you're not going to lose a lot of time. You may have 2 transactions a day versus 60. Life is good. You're not being bothered by this constant flow of people coming in just trying to destroy their neighborhoods.
Harry Webb is a pharmacist and owner of Webb's Family Pharmacy in Fulton County, Indiana.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, with packing, shipping, and moving supplies for both business and personal needs 7 days a week. Learn more at staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at curious.com/PRI.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The huge consolidation and transformation of the music business that has accompanied the growth of the internet has produced some very entertaining nostalgia for the good old days. The TV show Empire is a fictional drama inspired by Motown's Berry Gordy and looks at the success of hip-hop. Empire is in its 3rd season. But a big-budget attempt with Martin Scorsese and Mick Jagger to duplicate that success, telling the story of rock and roll on HBO, the series Vinyl, has crashed and burned. In trying to tell the stories of drugs and the music moguls of the 1970s, Vinyl's cancellation maybe tells an even better story of how the whole TV business model is changing in the 21st century. Melissa Locker, culture reporter for The Guardian and Time, says HBO has started the summer by cutting its losses big time.
It has. It has canceled Vinyl. I guess the needle is scratching across the vinyl right now.
Jesus. If any of the younger people in our audience have any idea what we're talking about. But is it because it's a bad show? Is it because it just was too fringy?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things working against Vinyl. One, the expectations for the show were incredibly high. It had Martin Scorsese, it had Mick Jagger.
Really?
It had so much going for it. So the expectations were incredibly high. It also had a massive budget. So it was expensive, and it had a lot of expectations, and it consistently failed to live up to them.
This world, though, is amazing. I mean, the world of – I mean, it's kind of like Empire meets Goodfellas, right? It's sort of the white version of the record world
in the 80s. Yeah, it was based in like 1970s New York, where the music industry is changing. Everyone's kind of hustling for the next big sound. They're looking at punk rock. They're looking at ways to turn bands like the New York Dolls into major label hits. And it has an incredible setting, and especially with the pedigree that was behind it, it should have been good. But expectations were high. The plot got really kind of off the rails. And there had been some mutterings that they were going to reboot the entire show for season two. But it wasn't one of those critically acclaimed shows that just didn't have an audience. It just didn't have an audience. Critics didn't love it. And it was expensive.
But what's the business model here? I mean, when HBO cancels something, it's certainly not because of the ratings in the traditional sense, because they're not getting ad revenue. Is it subscriptions? What is it?
I think they have sort of a brand that they're trying to upkeep, where they're putting out some of the best television around. I mean, honestly, only AMC kind of comes close to the quality the TV shows that they're putting out. They want to keep their fan base happy. They want to keep the subscriptions coming in. They want to keep their, you know, standalone deals coming in. But at the same time, they did come up with a second season of Ballers.
you're not down with that? Dwayne Johnson can do no wrong, you know.
That's another show that has an incredible cast, but I feel like it's just sort of Entourage with a sports theme, and I'm not the target audience for that show.
And your problem with that is?
Right. But Vinyl is definitely not one of those TV shows that people are going to miss. Like, I don't think in, you know, well, Vinyl the record may have had a resurgence 25 years later. I don't think people are going to look back at Vinyl the television show in 25 years and be like, man, people were really misunderstanding this show.
So that brings the question, in this era of quality television, I mean, is there a show that gets canceled that then will get resurrected in some down-the-road new universe of TV? Or are the shows that get canceled just ones that are awful?
Well, I feel like cancellation just doesn't mean what it used to. So, for example, take Nashville. It was on ABC, but it was very expensive because they had all these songs to license and all these songwriters to pay. And it got canceled, and people were pretty upset. And it got canceled on a serious cliffhanger. But now, gone are the days where a show got canceled and disappeared forever. Now you have places like Netflix or Hulu picking them up and recreating them. And now Nashville is going to CMT, which is great.
So we don't have the kind of show that gets canceled and comes back by popular demand. The popular demand is already clear. It's just moving to a different platform.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if you look back, shows like Freaks and Geeks probably would have gotten picked up by someone like Netflix. Or if you look at the Gilmore Girls revival, even Deadwood, which got canceled after two seasons on HBO, there's still talk about a movie coming out.
Melissa Locker, have a great next week.
Thank you. You too.
Melissa Locker is a culture reporter for The Guardian, Time, and for us.
Thanks for ruining my vacation, Ripley.
Well, I'll tell you something. This is no longer a vacation. It's a quest. It's a quest for fun.
It just doesn't matter.
Are you two heading for Las Vegas?
Yeah. We're going to score.
Boy, I sure wish I was going with you.
You got a helmet?
Oh, I've got a helmet.
Our quest is to get Rafer Guzman's insights about the movies this weekend, this blockbuster 4th of July weekend. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday. Welcome.
Hi, John.
So what do we got here? We got three very different kinds of movies here. Our Kind of Traitor is the first one. Tell me a little bit about it.
It's based on a John le Carré novel. Ewan McGregor plays a classics professor who gets mixed up in a Russian mobster MI6 espionage plot. He's going to ferry a thumb drive full of incriminating information to London.
I have some questions. Not tough. Medium soft. Is this all he gave you?
Yeah.
Didn't offer you any money?
Oh, he did, but I refused.
Then why did you bring it?
I thought it was the right thing to do. He said that his children would be killed if I didn't.
You believed him?
He seemed scared.
He told you he was a member of the Russian mafia. And you still agreed to help him.
So is Le Carré still holding steady in this era?
This is a late period novel of his from 2010, not one of his most probable. And as you can hear there, that's an MI6 agent asking Ewan McGregor some very obvious questions that really he can't answer, and neither can we. Why would you agree to ferry a thumb drive for a Russian mobster from Morocco to London and walk into an MI6 office? And I think the whole film is so implausible. Everyone's motivations are so thin that you can never step into this guy's shoes because he's just too dumb. He's too gullible. And it makes for a pretty lousy thriller, I have to say.
Speaking of implausible, The Legend of Tarzan. This is the Tarzan of the Ape, the Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Yes, indeed.
Movie. It made in once again. It's been made many, many times, and let's take a listen.
Keep your voice low.
That them?
You don't want to do that, George. Kill one and the rest won't stop until they're torn you to pieces.
So how you want to play this thing?
Their leader will come down and we'll fight.
So, an old story, but you've got Samuel L. Jackson, so it's got to work.
Well, he plays actually a real-life figure, George Washington Williams. He teams up with Tarzan, which I don't think happened in real life, and the two of them go into the Congo. They're going to stop another real-life figure, Leon Rom, Belgian guy, played by Christoph Waltz, who's always great. He's trying to enslave the entire country. So, I think once again, you've got the white savior problem here in Tarzan. And although Alexander Skarsgård is quite good in the role, and fans of his will be pleased to know that he's shirtless for much of the time, it's kind of a goofy Tarzan story. I feel like this character is very difficult to bring out of the early 20th century and bring him into the 21st. He's just too he's too campy, and I laughed my way through the movie. That scene right there where he's fighting a gorilla five times his size, you just can't buy it, you know? You don't buy it when he goes up to the lionesses and starts nuzzling them like a cub. It doesn't work for me.
The book was remarkably psychological. It sort of imagined what it would be like to only grow up amongst animals. And this sounds like special effects.
There are a lot of special effects, and they look fine. The movie looks pretty good. It's by the David Yates, the Harry Potter director. So it looks good. It has the feeling and the look of an old-fashioned adventure. But Tarzan himself, a little tough to modernize.
My kids were talking about whether to go see The Purge election year last night.
What made you apply for this position?
I like your politics.
No, I want a real answer.
I lost my son some years ago. He was killed. I almost did something on Purge night that would have destroyed a lot of lives. I want this night gone. I know you do too. Especially after what you lost.
So what do you think?
I don't know what kind of parent you are, John, but this is pretty bloody stuff as usual. Critics do not like these movies, but I do. I think they're a lot of fun. I think they're good, cheap, trashy movies with a lot of issues on their minds. And I think it works as good horror entertainment.
My oldest daughters are high school graduates, so they can do what they like.
You're
sunk,
John.
I can't say anything anymore. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Just imagine it, chatting with if our pets could talk, what stories and insights could they impart about the humans who rely on them for emotional support? Those all-powerful humans, right? Well, in the new film Wiener Dog, directed by Todd Solondz, a little dachshund is the companion of four very different and very flawed people. How do we learn of their very dark comic flaws? Well, let's just say the dog doesn't have to talk.
The movie, of course, has a dog at the center of it, but it's really a kind of conceit, because the real subject, I think, that ties all of these stories together is mortality and how it shadows and hovers over each of them and how the characters contend with that reality.
And the dog brings them a certain amount of happiness, I suppose, while they're here on Earth.
Well, I think pets are a funny thing. I love dogs, but we're all so anthropocentric, and it's hard not to anthropomorphize. They often become vessels, I think, for our hopes and yearnings and illusions. I think we project a certain kind of purity and innocence onto them, and it's hard to see a dog in its dogness.
You have a character in here named Dina, played by Julie Delpy, who sort of denies the dog's humanity, if you will, in a way. She plays a mother who has to break some sad news to her son.
All dogs get this done. Really, it's like going to the dentist and having your teeth cleaned. No big deal.
But what if Wiener Dog wants to have puppies?
She won't. Believe me, that's a total myth.
But what if Wiener Dog's different?
Honey, she's not. She's not like you and me. She doesn't think this way. She doesn't think. I mean, she's just a dog.
This is the kind of scene where, you know, a little boy is having his kind of world shattered, essentially. And I think this is the kind of scene that has led critics over the years to repeatedly call your movies dark comedies or bleak or even misanthropic comedies. But you don't see your movies that way. You never have. Do you get frustrated when critics react this way, even critics who love your movies?
No, I'm not frustrated. I'm happy when people respond in a way to the emotional life of the film, and that they can laugh or respond to the inherent social critique such as it is. I don't really have any complaints. Most movies out there maybe aren't always so compelling, and I suppose most critics aren't so compelling either, like in any field. I feel very grateful that I've been able to make as many movies as I've made. They're movies that I would have wanted to see were I not a filmmaker, and so they fill that imaginary vacuum for me.
I know you've been teaching at NYU for many years, where you yourself went to school for a while. And so I was sort of amused to see in this film, there's a screenwriting professor, a guy named Schmertz. His career is not going that well. He's a very sympathetic character played by Danny DeVito. His students, I would say, are portrayed in not the most flattering light.
You gotta have a what if. Simple as that. What if you got locked out of your house? What if your girlfriend cheated on you? What if you won the lottery? Then you would have a story. Then you would be in business.
I don't know.
I know.
Thanks for your time, Professor Schmertz.
Am I going out on a limb to assume that this is based on firsthand experience?
Well, it's a little bit elusive and a slippery slope to even try to begin to characterize him as an autobiographical sort of alter ego. I don't think anybody I know at film school or who knows me in real life would ever confuse me with such a character, though I have great sympathy and empathy for him. I teach full time at the graduate program at NYU, and I love the job. I love teaching. I love my students. I have some wonderful colleagues. But I also have the opportunity, being so up close to the school, to get to have learned just how it's managed with such incompetence and corruption, and how it really is such an evil empire, that NYU. So I go to work and I'm very happy, but it's hard for this not to inform this section. Although the story is not about the school, of course, it's really about a man and his quest for meaning and redemption.
Danny DeVito is great in this film, and you've got a lot of great actors in here. Greta Gerwig comes back as Dawn Wiener from Welcome to the Dollhouse. Fans of that film will be pleased to see her. When you write a role, do you have an actor in mind from the start?
No, I have to always be open-minded and fluid about that. And I like to be surprised by actors' names that come up that are suggested that I audition and so forth. It's interesting because Dawn Wiener, as you know, had been established in Welcome to the Dollhouse. And then in the movie Palindromes, I did kill her. And what I wanted to do here was offer yet another possible life trajectory. One of the pleasures of being a filmmaker is that not only can you create other lives, but you can create other lives, other lives. I can have actors reprise their roles or have other actors take on the roles originated by other actors. And this opens up a whole possibility of opportunities of meaning.
Speaking of actors, you use two dachshunds for the role of Wiener Dog?
More, I think three, four, really five, because we had a smaller one for when it's little. And the breed, I learned, actually has a kind of mental deficiency. These were show dogs that I was working with, and yet none of them could even respond to the simplest commands, stay, sit down. It even bit the little boy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that was the hardest part of the filming, but it did force me to rewrite some of the material. And I think I came up with other scenes that maybe are better for having been pushed into such a corner.
I've been talking to Todd Solondz. He's the writer and director of the new film, Wiener Dog. Todd, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday. Wiener Dog is in theaters now. Hey, give us a 4th of July memory, won't you?
Yes, this is John from Southern Indiana. 1976, I went to a 200-year fireworks celebration out there in New York Harbor. There was a lot of stuff going on there. It was quite the celebration.
Wall-to-wall boats, absolutely. 877-8MYTAKE is our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway. And today we welcome some new listeners. We're thrilled to be broadcasting on West Virginia Public Broadcasting, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. The Takeaway heard all across the Mountain State. Finally, this hour, maybe once in a while, we all get a chance to thank someone who influenced our lives as a kid, maybe a teacher or a coach. But what about someone you never met who was there for you, but they don't even know it? Our producer, John Asante, had the chance to connect with such a person in his life who showed up on a book tour. This goes way beyond a fan moment.
For me, it was a DJ, or a VJ in this case. I was about 12 years old, and Dave Holmes was the guy on MTV who'd fed my obsession for new music and who made me feel cool. He introduced me to some big pop hits and even some deep cuts. And so when I got a chance to talk with him, it turns out we both used our love of music as a way to fit in.
Music has always been playing in my life. I grew up Irish Catholic. My family was very much into music in kind of a more sensible way than I was. And also it was because my brothers were so much older than I was. It seemed like the only way, like the first way that I was able to fit in with my family was just by singing along with the radio. Music is love, really, for me. For some people, it's smell. For some people, it's sight. For me, it's a song. Like, if I hear a song that I haven't heard in 30 years, I remember everything about 1986.
With your family, what song or songs were the family songs that you guys would all sing together?
Oh, my first memory is early Wings, Jet, and Silly Love Songs.
Paul McCartney.
Yeah. Just the fact that everybody knew every word and everyone was singing along, and it was like a communal experience.
I mean, this is the time where Casey Kasem is just like...
Casey Kasem. Yeah.
Big, right.
Casey Kasem was a towering figure in my life because he took pop music seriously.
I'm Casey Kasem, and at number one last week on American Top 40 was this smash.
He would put effort into people's stories, and like he would read those long-distance dedications with such emotion, you know, and he knew that like certain people have to hear this song. It's going to bring them back together. It might make that runaway girl come back home or whatever. He would do American Top 40, and at the end he would read off that list of names of producers and whatnot, and like for a kid in the Midwest who saw no way forward for himself to think like maybe someday I'll be on a team like that. Like our life will be music.
And it seems like you found that first team when you were at Priory?
Yeah.
Catholic school.
Yeah, yeah, I went to an all-boys Catholic school, very conservative, and very in the manner of boys' schools, very fearful. There were like 40-something of us in a class, and you just didn't want to stand out. You wanted to be normal like everybody else. There was a small handful of us who were as into music video and music as I was, and we would find our little corner, and we would put in our little cassettes into our little boombox and, you know, listen to Pat Benatar and discuss it and get into it.
And this is at the point where you're also thinking more and more about your sexuality and what it means to who you were. That was something that you were battling. And what were, I guess, some of the songs that you really identified with in terms of like not being able to express yourself the way you wanted to?
You know, one thing that I remember really vividly was when Purple Rain came out.
Yeah.
Because that was just, that transcended. It didn't matter what kind of kid you were. You loved Purple Rain. And I remember I had a sleepover. A couple of my friends from school came over, And it was the summer between 7th and 8th grade. It was summer of 1984, which is a stellar summer for music. And we all three bought our individual copies of Purple Rain on vinyl. And then we went back to my house to listen to it. And one of my friends had like a bowl cut. And the other two of us were like, we were in more of like a hair-styled moment. And I had some mousse. And I remember talking to Derek and looking at John with his bowl cut and just saying, like, we're going to fix that. And just attacking him with mousse and giving him a more stylish look. Which, like, as I was doing it, I was like, this is not what a normal boy does. But Prince was playing, and Prince was in lingerie, and Prince was the biggest thing in the world. And it was like, I don't care what a normal boy does. For the moment, I'm like, Prince is on the stereo, and I'm free. And right. I'm gonna style my friend's hair. And he thanked me for it.
Then there was this turning point. Okay, I need to figure out who I am. I want to be comfortable with being gay. And the way you went about telling people.
Yeah. So I wrote an anonymous letter to the school newspaper about my experience being like a gay person on campus. And it's like reading it now, it is so overwrought and so like full of conflicted, self-loathing Catholic 19-year-oldness. But I'm glad that I did it because it did start a conversation. People did, you know, start to wonder whether there might be an actual homosexual in their midst. And they started to talk about it a little bit.
And then comes New York City, which
yeah,
it seems like it took a little while to get like find your footing. Like,
oh, sure.
Yeah.
I think at the time, like I felt like the only place to meet people was in bars. And the only place where there were bars was Chelsea. And everybody looked exactly the same. It was like an army of clones like I'd never seen before. And I didn't quite fit in. But I'm glad I didn't fit in.
I will say the one place where before you, I guess, maybe went on that path was to try out to be a VJ.
That's true.
The wannabe a VJ contest, which.
That's true. Yeah. It was a really crazy thing to have done. As I was, you know, wasting time at my job checking Billboard to see who was, you know, who was in the charts, there was a story that MTV was doing an open call for VJs. And I was like, well, okay, I'm going to circle that date on my calendar and I'm going to call in sick and I'm going to go. And I did, and it ended up being a thing that I didn't get the job, but I stuck around and I pushed and I was persistent. I was, you know, as stalkerish as I have ever been, and I pushed until I got myself a writing job, and then after a fashion I got put on the air. Like, it literally fundamentally altered the course of my life, and I almost blew it off to like sleep for 90 more minutes and then go to my job.
Right.
That's crazy.
And so between like hosting shows like Say What Karaoke,
yeah,
and then like getting it on TRL, you write about like the music videos that really, you know, really defined your time there and what,
yeah,
made it for you. Like, what I get, what still stands out to you, like in terms of artists and music? And
I mean, all of that boy band stuff, all of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC and Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera. I mean, that really, that is a golden age of pop music. I don't care. And those songs really stand up to know that I was like in some small part, I was there for somebody's like huge pop music awakening is so exciting. And to watch kids come into the studio or like hold signs out in Times Square, just to see the pure joy in their face, just to be near MTV was like you couldn't help but feel grateful and happy every single day.
What do you choose to listen to these days?
Ooh, I'm really into The Hold Steady. They're a band that reminds me so much of what I loved growing up. They're very influenced by The Replacements. But they're also men my age, you know, who are telling stories of men my age. But it doesn't feel like sad old guy music. It doesn't feel like something you would buy in a Starbucks or whatever. It's real and it's like vital and energetic. There is music being made by people my age that really feels like the freshest and most interesting thing there. I never would have imagined that happening. The devil and Sean Berryman, they took a walk together
and they ended up on Washington talking to the river. That was Takeaway producer John Asante talking with Dave Holmes, a former MTV VJ and currently an on-air personality on Sirius XM's The Spectrum. He's the author of Party of One, a memoir in 21 songs. Out this week. She said, you're pretty good with words, but words won't save your life, and they didn't, so he died. Finally, NASA is really figuring out this marketing stuff in space. It's actually using Jupiter to show off its latest mission, As the Juno probe approaches the big spot on the even bigger planet, the NASA website is showing the Jovian Northern Lights, the Aurora Borealis. Very impressive light show, enhanced with the latest sensor technology, no doubt. And listen to this. NASA says this is the sound of turbulence in Jupiter's gigantic magnetosphere. Of course it is. Have a great weekend. Have a great holiday, everyone. And you brand new folks from West Virginia Public Broadcasting, you come back on Monday now. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.